Season's greetings. I know what some of you are probably saying to yourselves, where is the Borough Assembly? Well, because of a cancellation, there is no assembly meeting tonight, and in its stead is a special edition of Fairbanks Arts Review. I say special because A, it's not normally scheduled for this time, and B, it affords me the opportunity to examine an institution dear to my heart, Fairbanks Drama Association. As many of you know, this is the last week they will be presenting Royal Gambit, a play about Henry VIII, his wives and the influence his personality had in fashioning our modern age. On tonight's program, I'll be taking you backstage while I talk with Gene DeWilde, the director of Royal Gambit, Richard Ussery, who plays Henry, as well as other members of the cast. I'm Robert Gilfillan, hoping you'll join me tonight on Fairbanks Arts Review.
Katharina of Aragon, to be my only wife, and promise that I will love you and keep you unto death. I, Henry Tudor, King of England, take you, Anne Boleyn, to be my wife, and promise that I will love you and keep you unto death. I, Henry Tudor, take you, Jane Seymour, to be my wife. Take you, Anna of Cleves, to be my wife. Take you, Catherine Howard, to be my wife.
Richard Ussery, portraying that enigmatic British monarch, Henry VIII, in Royal Gambit. Unlike more recent and popular treatments of Henry's reign, Royal Gambit suggests that Henry VIII and his times were seminal in creating our modern age. The play deals with such concepts as materialism, religion, and freedom of the will. In fact, playwright Hermann Gesicker has the action progress not only from wife to wife, but from age to age as well. This is realized graphically in the costume each wife dons as she marries Henry. Catherine of Aragon, Henry's first wife, assumes the traditional Tudor dress, while Kate Parr, his last wife, sports a modern pantsuit. And while I'm on the subject of costumes, I should mention Melinda Matheson's stunning realization of the dress. Each costume is created from hand-dyed silk, and the colors flow harmoniously from style to style. The set for FDA's production also reflects the tension of conflicting epochs and worldviews. One side of the stage is defined by sweeping stone arches, and the other is dominated by an abstract and fragmented portrait of a human face. In many ways, Royal Gambit breaks new ground in style and staging for FDA, and my first question for Gene DeWilde, the director, when I spoke to him and Richard Ussery, is what he looked for when choosing a play.
First of all, we've got to think in terms of the fact that we're doing community theater. And you know that there are certain people who are available, and you know that there will be some people who will appear when it comes time for an open reading and so forth. And so you have to cast or choose plays that are within the scope of your known talent and within the scope of that potential that's going to come in and read when you're casting a show. So there are certain limitations that are put on what you choose. There are some plays that, because of the nature of our theater, and I say this very reluctantly because I think you can do most anything in a small space, and you can change setting from what it was done on Broadway, but there are a few plays that just demand a bigger space or a different configuration in order to do it. It's like I would love to do something like The Dresser here sometime, but it does require a little more space than we might be able to get by with.
Well, the casting process is a sort of a surprise process often for a director, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Because you're drawing on the community, and sometimes, depending on the season, the community may not be available. Sometimes, though, too, you get lucky and you have an abundance of talent, and sometimes that magic or those magical actors that will realize your piece quite well. How has it been for you as a director here when you do cast? Is it mostly a fortuitous process?
Well, when I think of the shows that I've directed myself, I'm not speaking for some of the other shows other people have done. I've just done two this year, Pictures in the Hallway and Royal Gambit. I've been very fortunate in getting people in the cast that you know, start out with being able to comprehend the material and so forth. And I think that's, you know, that's half the director's job. You get a good cast, you're halfway there, or maybe more than halfway. You get a good cast, you do take care of the seeing that the technical things get done and it's mounted properly and it moves and it's smooth and it's clear sailing then.
Richard is one of those elements. I don't know how else to refer to it.
Star.
The star, of course. That's the...
You may kiss my ring.
How is it for you when you approach a role? Now, you're playing Henry VIII, and it's a pretty popular character for playwrights recently. I mean, A Man for All Seasons come to mind, and For a Thousand Days, the PBS and BBC series, Henry VIII and His Six Wives. When you get cast in a role like this, what kind of preparation do you go through, and how do you work as an artist and actor to prepare for a role?
Wow, good question. I think the first stage I go through, especially with a role like this, that is, this was a real person, a historical character, and everyone to a greater or lesser degree has some perceptions already of what they think of Henry VIII. The very first stage for me in finding out that I've been cast in a role like this is sheer terror. It is that it is, in fact, a pretty unapproachable, monumental kind of task. Then once you get that out of the way and you realize, well, regardless of how fearful this makes me, the curtain is going to go up, and we must in some fashion get our way toward that end. I tend to do varying amounts of historical research so that I know what, in this case, this real person, what his life was like. And yet there always comes a point where all of that research becomes secondary, because in actual fact what we're doing is the script, that play. This particular show is a good example. This playwright has exercised dramatic license very craftily, very cagily, which is, early in rehearsals I described it this way, he's telling lies about Henry, I'd say. And he does, in fact, but that is dramatic license. He does stretch the truth here and there. He does tell some outright lies about Henry, but he achieves a larger truth by the application of those fabrications. As a playwright, I felt very protective about Henry early on. There's no question that the playwright is bringing out a rather dark view of this man. Not negative, I wouldn't say, but because Henry is a very lively, playable person. But an actor can't portray a person that he doesn't like. I've very few times have had to face that problem. I can usually find something that I do like about, and one of the things about Henry that I found very attractive, and finally I got on more solid footing of, once I could finally accept the kind of power that this man can wield, which is very alien to our experience, certainly to my experience, I'll tell you. Once I could finally get on to some of that, that I have absolute life and death power over these people, once I could accept that truth, curiously, I found that kind of likable. What that says about me, I don't know. But it made...
You're a star.
Yes. It made the rehearsals really start to move for me then.
Lucifer, who am I?
I will tell you who I am. I am the man of the modern times. The man who frees his senses to become fully conscious of the great gift God has presented to him. The all-powerful reason. I am the man who crosses oceans and discovers beyond the oceans new continents. I am the man who is not afraid to question nature and to demand answers one after the other. I am the man whose genius penetrates the heavens and views the earth as, contrary to the scriptures, it is whirling about the sun in endless space. Yes, I understand all there really is, be it the way of the world, the way of the heart, be it the song of the stars, or the voice of conscience.
This play is not just an action piece. It draws certain philosophical and sociological implications and tries to make certain points about the modern man, and that's a phrase that reoccurs constantly throughout the play. I'll ask you both in turn. I'll start with Richard again. To talk to me about, when you're dealing with a play that has so many philosophical and intellectual elements, how do you make it move as a driving dramatic piece, instead of just, let's say, a diatribe or a proposition, a philosophical proposition?
Another good question, because the terms philosophical and intellectual are not words I ever use in trying to entice someone to buy a ticket. But in fact, it is a large portion of this play. That doesn't mean that we dust off our soapbox and preach, at least we try not to. But there is a message in this play. There is something being said by the author. I think getting at that mainstream of thought, let me observe in passing, this author does not keep these characters in the historical time that they lived in. He lets us see all the implications that he lets Henry realize the changes that he wrought in the world. Henry knows that atomic power is in the world. By the last act of the show, we know that that is a factor that came about in part because of the changes Henry VIII made. So we are not dealing with the kind of philosophy that keeps us in the 1600s, 1500s, excuse me, but that these people feel the reverberations of what the impact of their actions were. That helps to make it much more lively. And then playing it as actors dealing with that philosophy, of course, we don't stress the philosophy, we stress the relationships between the people. As always in any play, the conflict between people is where the action is.
Let me ask you, Gene, the same question. How do you, as a director, keep this piece moving, let's say in terms of blocking?
Let me go back to just a choice of material, because I think I do the same thing as a director in thinking and choosing right away. When I read a play for the first time I sit down and read it, I like to just sit down and read it, force myself not to think of it as an actor, because actors have a tendency to then zero in on a role as they read it. But just sit down and read it for the sheer enjoyment of reading it. And what do you get out of it that first time you read it? The enjoyment you got out of it that time. You're going on, then you start analyzing and so forth later on. But if you keep pulling yourself back to your original, what you enjoyed about it, what was good about it, what was exciting and what moved about it, I think that's kind of the key to where you go then, you know, because you can get terribly involved in analysis and so forth, and it's not that that isn't important, but sometimes that's where you can start to drag and fall behind and start getting dull. Mm-hmm. With this piece, you talk about the movement of the play. I enjoy doing this kind of a thing because the movement of the play, the actual blocking of the play, is, I feel, very important to the moving of the story. And I don't know how it happened, but just created a piece in the middle of the floor, and it seemed to work. And as you're directing, you feel moments when you want Henry in the strong position. You feel moments when you want Katharine in the strong position. And because it is circular, it's easy to move those people into those positions, and it just sort of happens. And I'm not a terribly analytical person when it comes to blocking a show. I guess if there's one, I have one strong point as a director, it's blocking. To visually get something that is interesting, regardless of what kind of stage it is.
Maybe we should mention for the listeners, when we're talking about this set, this is a unique set design and also a house design for FDA, because what they've done in this show is divide the house in half. So in essence, the actors are right in the middle of two opposing ranks of chairs or for the audience to sit in. So it's almost like theater in the round. And how does that, I'll ask you right now, you both, how is it to play in a house like that? How is it to block for something like that as opposed to the proscenium arch?
Some shows lend themselves much better to that kind of thing. It's one of the reasons why I chose to do it with this show, because I knew this show had to be a show that in order to keep it interesting with what's being said and so forth, it had to have something visually happening to you. You can't just set your actors down and have them talk for 10, 15 minutes. And this show could do that very easily. In fact, if you read the italics in this show, that's exactly what they apparently did on a proscenium stage. And you can't do it with audience on both sides. You've got to keep the characters have to keep moving so that the audience isn't always looking at somebody's back. And the angles are such in this that they're constantly shifting. So you see somebody with a profile, you see them from the back, you see them from the front. It also adds another acting dimension for the actors. I think an actor working in this kind of a situation has to develop themselves into an all-round actor. They're, and I mean literally all around them.
Really?
Somebody is peeking no matter what. If you've got your hands behind your back and you're nervous and your fingers are twitching, somebody's saying, what's going on here? They see it. So you have to be much more on your toes in this kind of theater, I think. It's just a...
Is that true, Richard?
Oh, yeah, I agree completely. One of the things, you know, I also direct occasionally, and I'll sometimes say, as I heard Gene say during rehearsals for this show, act with your back, people, I'll say. And it is true. It's really helped sharpen and clean up my work to be aware of that. People don't do much work in the round, especially in Fairbanks. It's a very unusual style, arena staging. Something that it makes very obvious to the audience, something about the arena style, is not only are you looking at the actors, but beyond them, you're also seeing the audience, and that underscores for you what the essential nature of the theater-going experience is about. It occurs between the players and the people receiving that playing. Well, it's crystal clear when you see it in the arena. You can see those people over there. Yes, it has been very challenging working that way. Sometimes you like to think, yeah, I got my shoulder blade just right for that one, see ya. I'm not sure that that's happening or not, but you like to think you're getting it right anyway.
The set has been called, I know, by one critic, impressionistic. And at one end of this sort of, for lack of a better word, alley of performance space, there is an abstract expressionist, a painting or a sculpture, yeah. A wall sculpture.
Well, let me put it this way. The Zollsdorfs agreed to do a set for us. And Mrs. Zollsdorf and I guess Dean, too, he works in architecture, but they're both sculptors. And they sort of tentatively decided that one would do one end of the stage and one the other. And my concept was kind of that since the play starts in the Tudor period, but we come all the way up into the modern and we talk about the bomb, and the destroying of the world and so forth, why not let it progress from something that was typically Tudor to the something that's impressionistic of the explosion of the world, the end of the world, Armageddon, anything you want to call it anyhow, over at the other side, and let the stage give that impression also, since that's what we're going to be doing as the actors. And they did that, and I think quite nicely. Then, out of necessity, in order to start rehearsing and so forth, I developed this centerpiece in the set in order, and that's basically what I work around. And then, as I found out, you know, what direction they were going with it, it blended in beautifully with what I wanted to do. I was able to pull into the impressionistic end. I was able to pull into the more realistic Tudor end of the set, and I think it lent itself very well to the development of the script.
I also cornered some of Henry's wives to find out their perspectives of life with a ruler. First, Susan Hackett, followed by Carrie Larkin and Laura Curtin.
Oh, my Savior, I see it as the will of God to let man inherit the earth just once for one brief earth hour. I can see that hour in the splendor of its high minutes and in the horror of its last seconds, and I bow my head before the wisdom of the Almighty, whom it is pleased to let this come to pass.
As far as you are concerned, Henry of England, how does it begin for you, this new...
I now happen to be talking to Susie Hackett, who's playing Catherine of Aragon, Henry VIII's first wife. And in this play, it seems that the implication is that she was the real soulmate, or the immortal partner, if you will, of Henry VIII. I asked Richard this. What kind of research did you go through in order to prepare yourself for this role?
Well, I read a number of things about Katerina of Aragon, and she was an extremely devout Catholic, of course, and that, of course, was reflected not only in this play, but in her approach to her marriage and in her struggle with Henry for her rights as Queen of England. And I use that as an approach to my part. I play her in a very conservative manner. And I think she represented that point of view, and this is a very representational piece. And so glomming onto that kind of thing, I think, is what is important in presenting the queens, because each character has to be a little bit different, and I think that each of us has had to focus on something that really sort of summarizes what that character would have been in real life.
This may seem like a difficult question, but you're not a professional actress. You're part of the community, and you come in here to perform art, if you will, acting. How is it for you to do that? You don't have the time. You don't have the experience, let's say, of a professional actor where you can always just concentrate on your craft and art.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find it difficult as just, what can I say, a citizen or a member of the community to come in and suddenly exercise these artistic muscles that don't often have a chance to be exercised?
I think what is difficult from that standpoint is maintaining the concentration that's required in order to perform and in order to maintain a character, whether you're doing it from the standpoint of a professional person or whether you're doing it as an amateur. And as an amateur performer, I think that is the most difficult thing because concentration is extremely important. I find myself running my lines a lot, even though that doesn't necessarily guarantee you're not going to fumble somewhere along the line. And I think that element is probably the biggest difference. A professional person spends 8 hours a day or a great deal of his time concentrating on his craft and concentrating on
to be wrong with the monitor, which means what's going have to be awfully careful.
What's going on, and sort of like now, and that I think is the difficult part, the concentration, maintaining that so that when you go on stage, you are as much of that character as you can be.
Gary, you play Catherine Howard, who is the other wife, besides Anne Boleyn, who's beheaded. How do you feel as an actress playing such a doomed figure? And since you also represent a certain sexual freedom, how do you go about, when you're acting, trying to communicate that?
Well, that's an interesting question. Playing the doomed character, as you put it, is, to me, I love it. I think it's wonderful. It's challenging, and there's just so much to work with and so many deep things in Catherine's character that I just love it.
I'm often puzzled and interested what draws members of the community into a theater like FDA. What is it about acting that attracts you? What do you find about acting?
Well, I've been interested in acting ever since I can remember. And to have a real solid reason behind why I'm interested in it is really hard for me because it's just sort of like a compulsion with me. It's like a painter that feels compelled to paint or a dancer that feels compelled to dance. It's just a compulsion, just something that it's more like something that I feel that I have to do. And also I want to do it, but I feel like it sort of makes my life seem more whole. And for me, the community theater is really wonderful because being that I live in a community where there isn't professional theater and being that a lot of us who are in amateur theater wouldn't be able to be in professional theater anyway, community theater is a great outlet for us and it's a great way to learn. Someday I would like to be in professional theater, but for right now, what I'm doing here with FDA is really fulfilling to me.
I feel like I've learned something from playing Kate Parr, just because I feel like she's somebody that I like.
Why do you like her?
I like her because I feel like she's very calm and she knows what she wants and she's just very in control of her life. And in some aspects of my life, that's something that I envy. I'm like, oh, that'd be nice. And I found myself doing a couple things in real life in the past, you know, 3 or 4 weeks. And I've compared my reaction or the way I do something to the way Kate Parr would do it. I thought, well, maybe I should try to be a little bit more like Kate Parr, you know.
How do you think Kate Parr would react to someone interviewing her on radio?
Oh, she would she would love it, I think, and she would express herself very well. She wouldn't stumble over her words at all. And I would envy that in her also.
Finally, I spoke with a performer who made a guest appearance on the night I was recording, Dennis Lee, who is the interpreter for the hearing impaired. It's a service FDA provides at least once during a main stage production.
Dennis, you do speech interpretation for the deaf on these. Is that correct? Or what would be a better way of stating what you do on these performances?
What I'm doing is using sign language to convey what was said spoken. What a lot of people might not know is that sign language is its own language, American Sign Language. It happens to be used in North America and Canada and the United States. It's not universal, you know, around the world. As a matter of fact, even within North America, there's a regionalism. There, a sign may be a vocabulary item may be signed differently in the Northwest than it would in Southern California, and the same with Kansas or Texas. And that's just speaking of the lexical item or the sign itself. Now, when you get into syntax and the way they're put together, that varies too. And that's a big part of the language, needless to say. Actually, American Sign Language is more like Chinese than it is in English. You know, there's you're really dealing with pictures a lot. Chinese, the pictures are on paper, and in American Sign Language, they're in the air. Sign language does not follow the kind of grammar that we're used to. You know, you take the grammar of your native language for granted, but when you start looking at sign language, you have to be aware that you are looking at a different, completely different language with its own sets of rules and regulations.
So you actually have dialects in sign language?
Oh yeah, you can pick a, you know, the same way you can pick where a person lives if they're a speaking person, if they're a hearing person. By their speech, by their spoken dialect, you can oftentimes be aware of where a person is from by the way they sign. For example, the regionalism is in sign languages. The sign for old that's pretty standard across the country is sort of like pulling at a beard, an old man's beard, with sort of a fist shape that you would grab a hammer, that kind of hand shape. Sort of like pulling the beard down. That's the standard sign for old. And then around the Toledo, Ohio area, just that one area, they have basically the same handshake, but it pulls off the nose, you know, and just for no apparent reason. I mean, of course, someone could study and figure it out, but those kinds of variations are real common.
Now, with a pretty wordy play like this tends to be, with a lot of philosophical and religious notions in the script, how do you manage to keep up with the train of thoughts and speech?
Well, basically, I just about memorize every play, you know, all the lines, so that I know what's coming up. And certain parts I'm able to say quickly, and other parts I might want to give more emphasis, depending if I know that it needs to be emphasized for clarification for the person to understand what's going to be coming up next. And quite frankly, if it's a small point that is not real necessary for following maybe a line that's going to be coming up in the future or part of the play, it might be brushed over depending on how many lines I have to squeeze into a certain amount of time.
I noticed that you do as much work with facial expressions and hand gestures as you do with the actual language.
I guess the average person who doesn't know much about sign language might think that it was all on the hands. Actually, a whole lot of meaning is conveyed with the rest of the body, on the face, on the way the body is held. If you notice, I might shift my body weight to the right or to the left, and sort of turn to the right or to the left. This indicates direct discourse. It can be, you know, one person speaking, then the other person responding, and that sort of thing. Even if the other person's not on stage, like, you know, if Henry is talking to God, you know, I may have Henry have my body inclined looking upward as I talk for Henry to God, and then God will then be looking down.
Oh, yes. Don't forget God. Don't forget God. Brothers, somewhere above the firmament lives a dear father. Search for God. Top priority project. Crash program to find God.
We just heard from members of FDA's production of Royal Gambit, the final three performances of which take place tonight, Friday and Saturday. For more information or tickets, just call 456-PLAY. I hope you all have a joyous season. I'm Robert Gilfillan, and I'll see you next week. And now for a movable feast. Local broadcast of A Movable Feast is made possible by a grant from A Movable Feast, located in the Northgate Square.
A Movable Feast. Hi, I'm Tom Vitale. On this program, Galway Connell reads from his selected poems. Connell is the author of 4 books of translation, a short novel, and 7 volumes of poetry, including Body Rags, What a Kingdom It Was, The Book of Nightmares, and Mortal Acts, Mortal Words. Connell was born in Providence, Rhode Island in 1927. He grew up in nearby Pawtucket. He went to college at Princeton, to graduate school at the University of Rochester, and he has since taught at universities across the nation. In 1983, Connell was given the American Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize for his selected poems. At the time, in the New York Times, Morris Dickstein called Connell one of the master poets of his generation and a writer whose career exemplifies some of what is best in contemporary poetry. And now, Galway Connell reading from his selected poems.
First one is for William Carlos Williams. When you came and you talked, and you read with your private zest from the varicose marble of the podium, the lovers of literature paid you the tribute of their almost total inattention, although someone, when you spoke of a pig, did squirm, and it is only fair to report another giggled. But you didn't even care. You seemed above remarking we were not your friends. You hung around inside the rimmed circles of your heavy glasses and smiled, and so passed a lonely evening. In an hour of talking, your honesty built you a tower. When it was over and you sat down and the chairman got up and smiled and congratulated you and shook your hand, I watched a professor in neat bow tie and enormous tweeds, who patted a faint praise of the sufficiently damned, drained spittle from his pipe, then scrammed. This is a little section from The Avenue Bearing the Initial of Christ into the New World. It simply describes an old woman who used to sit on the corner of Fifth Street and Avenue C, next to what was then High's Luncheonette, selling newspapers. First Sunday of the year. Tonight, when the sun will have turned from the earth, she will appear outside High's Luncheonette, the crone who sells the news and the mirror, the oldest living thing on Avenue C, outdating much of its brick and mortar. If you ask for the news, she gives you the mirror and squints long at the nickel in her hand, despising it, perhaps, for being a nickel, and stuffs it in her apron pocket and sucks her lips. Rain or stars, every night she is there, squatting on the orange crate, issuing out only in darkness, like the cucarachas and strange nightmares in the chambers overhead. She can't tell one newspaper from another. She has forgotten how nine her dead husband looked. She has forgotten her children's whereabouts, or how many there were, or what the news and mirror tell about that we buy them with nickels. She is sure only of the look of a nickel, and that there is a Lord in the sky overhead. She dwells in a flesh that is of the Lord, and drifts out, therefore, only in darkness, like the street lamp outside the luncheonette, or the lights in the secret chamber in the firmament, where Yahweh himself dwells, like Magdalene in the Battistero of St. John on the carved-up continent, in the land of sun, she lives shadowed under a feeble bulb that lights her face, her crab's hands, her small bulk on the crate. She is Pulcheria, mother of murderers and madmen. She is also Alyona, whose neck was a chicken leg. Mother, was it the insufferable wind? She sucks her lips a little further into the mouse hole. She stares among the stars and among the street lamps. The mystery is hers. Vapor trail reflected in the frog pond. The old watch, their thick eyes puff and foreclose by the moon. The young heads trailed by the beginnings of necks shiver in the guarantee they shall be bodies. In the frog pond, the vapor trail of a sack bomber creeps. I hear its drone drifting high up in immaculate ozone. And I hear, coming over the hills, America singing. Her varied carols I hear. Crack of deputies' rifles practicing their aim on stray dogs at night. Sput of cattle prod. TV groaning at the smells of the human body. Curses of the soldier as he poisons, burns, grinds, and stabs. The rice of the world with open mouth, crying strong, hysterical curses. And by rice paddies in Asia, bones wearing a few shadows walk down a dirt road, smashed bloodsuckers on their heels, knowing the flesh a man throws down in the sunshine, dogs shall eat, and the flesh that is upthrown in the air shall be seized by birds, shoulder blades smooth, unmarked by old feather holes. Hands rivered by blue, erratic wanderings of the blood, eyes crinkled up as they gaze up at the drifting sun that gives us our lives, seed dazzled over the foot-battered blaze of the earth. The bear. In late winter, I sometimes glimpse bits of steam coming up from some fault in the old snow, and bend close and see it is lung-colored, and put down my nose and know the chilly, enduring odor of bear. I take a wolf's rib and whittle it sharp at both ends, and coil it up, and freeze it in blubber, and place it out on the fairway of the bears. And when it has vanished, I move out on the bear tracks, roaming in circles until I come to the first tentative dark splash on the earth. And I set out running, following the splashes of blood wandering over the world. At the cut, gashed resting places I stop and rest, at the crawl marks where he lay out on his belly to overpass some stretch of bocce ice, I lie out, dragging myself forward with bear knives in my fists. On the third day I begin to starve. At nightfall I bend down as I knew I would, at a turd sopped in blood, and hesitate, and pick it up, and thrust it in my mouth, and gnash it down, and rise, and go on running. On the seventh day, living by now on bear blood alone, I can see his upturned carcass far out ahead, a scraggled, steamy hulk, the heavy fur riffling in the wind. I come up to him and stare at the narrow-spaced, petty eyes, the dismayed face laid back on the shoulder, the nostrils flared, catching, perhaps, the first taint of me as he died. I hack a ravine in his thigh, and eat and drink, and tear him down his whole length, and open him, and climb in, and close him up after me against the wind, and sleep, and dream of lumbering flat-footed over the tundra, stabbed twice from within, splattering a trail behind me, splattering it out, no matter which way I lurch, no matter which parabola of bare transcendence, which dance of solitude I attempt, which gravity-clutched leap, which trudge, which groan. Until one day I totter and fall, fall on this stomach that has tried so hard to keep up, to digest the blood as it leaked in, to break up and digest the bone itself. And now the breeze blows over me, blows off the hideous belches of ill-digested bear blood and rotted stomach and the ordinary wretched odor of bear, blows across my sore, lolled tongue a song or screech until I think I must rise up and dance, and I lie still. I awaken, I think. Marsh lights reappear. Geese come trailing again up the flyway. In her ravine under old snow the dam bear lies, licking lumps of smeared fur and drizzly eyes into shapes with her tongue. And one hairy-souled trudge stuck out before me, the next groaned out, the next. The rest of my days I spend wandering, wondering what anyway was that sticky infusion, that rank flavor of blood, that poetry by which I lived. St. Francis and the Sow. The bud stands for all things, even for those things that don't flower. For everything flowers from within of self-blessing. Though sometimes it's necessary to reteach a thing its loveliness, to put a hand on its brow of the flower and retell it in words and in touch it is lovely until it flowers again from within of self-blessing. As St. Francis put his hand on the creased forehead of the sow and told her in words and in touch, blessings of earth on the sow. And the sow began remembering all down her thick length, from the earthen snout all the way through the fodder and slops to the spiritual curl of the tail, from the hard spininess spiked out from the spine down through the great broken heart to the sheer blue milken dreaminess spurting and sheddering from the 14 tits into the 14 mouths sucking and blowing beneath them, the long, perfect loveliness of sow. Blackberry eating. I love to go out in late September among the fat, overripe, icy, black blackberries to eat blackberries for breakfast. The stalks very prickly, a penalty they earn for knowing the black art of blackberry making. And as I stand among them, lifting the stalks to my mouth, the ripest berries fall almost unbidden to my tongue, as words sometimes do, certain peculiar words like strengths or squinched, many-lettered, one-syllabled lumps, which I squeeze, squinch open, and splurge well in the silent, startled, icy, black language of blackberry eating in late September. After making love, we hear footsteps. For I can snore like a bullhorn, or play loud music, or sit up talking with any reasonably sober Irishman, and Fergus will only sink deeper into his dreamless sleep, which goes by all in one flash. But let there be that heavy breathing or a stifled come cry anywhere in the house, and he will wrench himself awake and make for it on the run. As now, we lie together after making love, quiet, touching along the length of our bodies, familiar touch of the long married. And he appears, in his baseball pajamas, it happens, the neck opening so small he has to screw them on, which one day may make him wonder about the mental capacity of baseball players, and flops down between us and hugs us and snuggles himself to sleep, his face gleaming with satisfaction at being this very child. In the half-darkness, we look at each other and smile and touch arms across this little startlingly muscled body, this one whom habit of memory propels to the ground of his making. Sleeper, only the mortal sounds can sing awake. This blessing love gives again into our arms.
Let's talk about the poems you read.
Okay.
You knew William Carlos Williams, right?
Yeah.
And is it true that he advised you to write about what you know, and that you sent him your first song?
Well, I did. I did once read him a poem about some farm boys making music with cornstalk violins in the prairies of Illinois, and he wasn't too taken by it. He did ask. He did inquire as to whether I'd ever done this or not. And of course, I told him no. It's just a dream, a fantasy. And but he thought it was better to write about what you see, feel, touch, smell, and so on around you. And I was in fact living then on Avenue C, and was in fact doing that, walking around with my notebook and pencil, more or less on the model that I discovered in Walt Whitman, where he describes how he wandered along Broadway, poking in here, looking at this and that, and so on. And Williams, and I read to Williams that long poem, "The Avenue Bearing the Initial of Christ into the New World," and he liked it much better.
If we could talk about that, how do you build a poem? Your poems have this, you know, mystical intensity. How does that arise? I mean, these things that you chew over a matter of months. I mean, you get a thought. I mean, you're out in the country, something's running through your mind, and then you sit down and you come down with a line. How do you construct a poem? I mean, the bear, we could talk about that.
Well, in quite different ways, really, depending on which poem. In a poem like The Bear, which is a narrative, I wrote that in this way. I read in a book called The Top of the World just a throwaway line in a little paragraph that describing one of the ways Eskimos used for hunting bears, and something in it stuck with me, stuck in my craw, you could say. And about a year later, one night in Alabama, I think, staying at Rosalind Brown's house, I was unable to sleep due to some crisis in my own life. And I remember walking around to the people in the house. I was talking to Rosalind recently about this. I saw her a few weeks ago, asking if anybody had a sleeping pill, because I was lying blind awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. Nobody did. So instead of sleeping, I just got up and wrote out the narrative of this poem, as I could imagine it might have felt from the point of view of the hunter. And then it was perhaps about a month or two later that I continued the poem and wrote out the same narrative from the point of view of the bear. But that's a kind of an unusual way for me to write, since I don't really write narrative poems that much. At least the poems I've written in more recent years have been built of thoughts and images woven together in some kind of form that I think of as basically an ode, some meditative form. And in that case, it takes me quite a long time to write it. And I'm not sure. I'm not sure very often where in the poem certain thoughts or images should come, so that the whole architecture of the poem for a little while is left suspended the way, of course, it is not in a narrative poem. And gradually I just through going through it again and again, get a feel for how I think it should begin and flow, and then the problem becomes to discover the end. If one knows the end of the poem before writing it, there's no point in writing it. So for me, the important thing is to set forth as many of the elements that form the that form what you might call the, not exactly the problem of the poem, but that the issue the poem is addressing, to get all the elements that I can into words and into the right order, and then try to figure out or understand what it all might mean.
Mm-hmm. In your poems, you write about your life, and then you write about other things, other lives, as if they were yours. I mean, your senses are the bear's senses, and the hen flower, and the sow, and St. Francis and the sow. Almost in blackberry eating, we feel like what it's like to be a crushed blackberry, almost. How do you get involved, I suppose, in that way? Or how did you come to start imagining it, to put yourself in other circumstances like that?
Well, it's an interesting and difficult subject. How and to what extent, and whether in a way it's right, you know. First of all, I think you can't write about anything without sympathy. And if you do have sympathy, you, in some way, to some degree, slip into that person's, or that thing's, or that creature's being for a moment. But, of course, we really don't know other beings from the inside, and so one has to hold back, you know. You can't really pretend to know what you don't know. There has to be some respect paid to the thing itself. So for example, in the bear, it's clear that that is not a bear. That is not a bear's consciousness. That is a man inside a bear, and the bear at that point has become symbolic of something, some aspect of a human psyche. So the bear, which, you know, perhaps is accorded a good deal of separate life in the first part of the poem, really disappears from the second part as the speaker identifies with the bear. And what happens, ideally what happens, I don't know if it happens in that poem or in any of my poems, but ideally what would happen is that the speaker, the poet, would give a voice to something that has no voice, would articulate its life as if from inside, and the thing would give to the poet a vocabulary by which the poet could articulate his or her inner experience. So with some strange union, in that strange union, both the world speaks, and the inner life of the poet, or let's say of the human being at that point, because no longer the actual individual experience is no longer interesting. The the inner experience of the human being, finds a language by which it can express itself.
I think of Walt Whitman's poetry sometimes when I read your work, and he celebrated, you know, the leaves of grass, the single bodies of the souls of single blades of grass, and listed everything about him, and he sang a song of America. And of course, in your own poem, The Vapor Trail Reflected in the Frog Pond, you know, I hear America singing, but you hear rifle cracks and sack bombers flying overhead. And it seems to me that a Walt Whitman sang as you do, but sang, he celebrated everything, whereas in your poetry, you protest whatever, the ills.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see as the function of your poetry?
A lot has changed in the 100 years since Whitman wrote I Hear America Singing, and those days, particularly the days of the Vietnam War, when and the civil rights movement, when one felt particularly sharply the disappointment of all the hopes that Whitman set forth. Whitman saw what was happening in this country, but he sang despite it, because he hoped, in a way, by the sincerity and passion and eloquence of his voice, somehow to lift up this country and let it fulfill that vision he had for it. But of course that was not possible, and today I don't think anybody dreams that poetry can lift up this country in that way. I think what, socially speaking, what poetry can do is try to figure out what's going on in terms of the psyche of this country, of the individuals within it, so that if, for example, one wanted to write about nuclear weapons in poetry, I would think such matters as, or one of the matters that would be appropriate to talk about would be the death wish of Homo sapiens, the evident prospect that the human race will commit suicide, and then one could well ask what is going on inside us that that makes racial suicide a possibility. That is a subject that poetry can perhaps explore as well as any other medium.
Galway Knell. His selected poems are published by Houghton Mifflin. For more information about A Movable Feast or a list of available cassettes, write to In Our Time Arts Media, Post Office Box SS, Old Chelsea Station, New York, New York, 10113. Once again, our address is In Our Time Arts Media, Post Office Box SS, Old Chelsea Station, New York City, 10113. Funds for this program are provided in part by the Witterbinner Foundation for Poetry and by the Academy of American Poets. Theme music by The Minx, the mixing engineer Manoli Wetherell. With contemporary literature on A Movable Feast, I'm Tom Vitale.
Local broadcast of A Movable Feast was made possible by a grant from A Movable Feast, located at Northgate Square.